This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network.
TalkSport. Powered by fans.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the results, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly teaming up with Three for Mental Health Awareness Week this year. Beyond the pitch, beyond the results, we're here to connect fans, getting them to embrace the highs and lows of supporting your club, because we're not just fans, we're a team. With 2 in 3 football fans having struggled with their mental health, we understand that life off the pitch can present its own challenges. That's why we're committed to ensuring you have the tools to stay connected with your friends and fellow supporters. Take a moment to connect with your mates. A simple text or an open conversation can make a world of difference. And if they don't respond right away, don't hesitate to follow up. Let's all take a moment to talk more than football.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of My Argyle Life, this series in which we take a deep dive into the lives and stories of those among us on the terraces of Home Park and across the country. Joining us today is Matt Tiller. How are you?
I'm very good, Aaron. Yeah, good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. I imagine most people will know yourself and Greg for the outstanding work with the Jack Leslie campaign. But before we get into Jack, let's learn a little bit more about you and your love of Argyle. Not that I've been snooping on your LinkedIn profile, but your life's work lists things such as a producer, director, writer, singer, songwriter, and of course, campaigner.
Yeah.
But for people who are unfamiliar with your work, and to quote a famous terrorist chant, who are you?
Who are you? Yeah. I moved to Plymouth. Well, I did. My parents did when I was about 4. He was in the army at 29 Commando in the Citadel, so they weren't really football fans. And I was into football, but back then, you know, I didn't have any friends that were Argyle fans. And I'm afraid I sort of started glory hunting as about a 4-year-old supporting Liverpool. But I was soon dragged out of that by some very sensible Plymouth friends, school friends, who turned me on to Argyle. And it kind of coincided with a bit like now, a bit of a golden period. So the cup run of 84, where there was massive excitement in the city. And I really wanted to go to that semi-final, but I was just too young. And my parents said, no, that's not happening. But a couple of seasons later, I started to go with a school friend, Ash, and really got into it, and then got a season ticket. And so I was there in the Dave Smith 86 season. So it was a great time to start. And, I ran on the pitch at the end of that Bristol game. And it was all these memories are slightly vague, but I remember those. In fact, I watched one of the Argyle things with Nance the other day, and showed one of the header, the Tommy Tynan header. And it's like, that atmosphere just suddenly came back inside me.
Yeah, I was listening to that earlier, actually. He was talking about the Tommy Tynan goal, right? The diving header from the corner. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was an amazing game. You've basically answered my next question, which is, I've been told that you're not Plymouth born, but you're Plymouth bred, basically. And you had an interesting start to life on the Hoe.
Yeah, well, when my dad left the army a few years later, he and my mum bought a guest house. I think it's still there, the Lamplighter. So I grew up in a guest house with, you know, people coming in and out from all different places and countries. And it was great growing up on the Hoe in Plymouth. It was fantastic.
Have any like new signings stay there whilst they were trialing? Or
no, I think even, although I'm, it was a very nice place. It was a little B&B on the Hoe, so I don't think we ever had any players stay with us. We had after that a little hotel that was called the Drake. The Drake's still there, and on Lockyer Street. So we occasionally had the odd, very minor celeb, but I don't think we ever had an Argyle player or an opposition player stay with us, sadly. I did once see Tommy Tynan in the this is going to sound a bit weird now, but in the changing rooms, he was fully dressed and so was I. But in the changing rooms at the Holiday Inn swimming pool, I think Greg was the member, and I used to go as a guest. I saw him there, and I think he had his Argyle top and shorts on. And I was starstruck, you know, because he was an absolute legend. So I was a bit like, I couldn't even speak to him.
Yeah, not quite as legendary as Tommy Tynan, but that's exactly the same pool in which I shared a changing room with Lee Hodges. So that was quite fun.
That's not bad.
Yeah. So maybe it's that. Maybe if you want to go and meet players, former players, go there. It's the Crown Plaza now. Is that the same one?
Yes. Yeah. Same hotel. Yeah.
Your early days then as an Argyle fan, what do you remember about your first game?
I don't remember much about my first game. I do remember, you know, I kind of have sort of vague memories and sort of feelings. And we used to sort of go between, I think I started going on the Lyndhurst. So I remember sort of running on in that after that promotion game from the Lyndhurst. And then me and my mate Ash had season tickets in the Mayflower. It was just great. Those were sort of great times, but obviously over my many years since, it's been up and down and up, if that makes sense.
Yeah, a bit of a roller coaster.
Yes.
What was it like following Argyle in the mid to late 80s then? Obviously, who are your idols? You've already mentioned Tommy there, but is there anybody you look up to?
Well, aside from, I mean, definitely Kevin Hodges, because he was, you know, as much as someone like Jack Leslie and some of the other people that played with Jack, like Sammy Black, he's there in the record books and was, you know, immense for many, many years. So I'd say, you know, they're obvious, like Tommy Tynan and Kevin Hodges, but I was a big fan of Jeff Crudgington in goal. I think the players that really kind of stuck out that I sort of noticed their craft more were probably when I was a little bit older. So sort of going into the 90s, and people like Steve McCall, who just had, you know, great vision. And I mean, he looked about 50 when he was, I don't know, late 20s, but he was brilliant. And Steve Castle, who was a really kind of immense attacking midfielder, scored like an incredible amount of goals. Those sort of players, and obviously you're probably going to ask me my favourite Argyle memory.
That's literally the next question. So you can answer that if you like.
Why don't I just go on? Because that 96 playoff final. Yeah, it's strange to my sort of memory of that, because through the campaign, getting to know Ronnie Moje, who, you know, was such a legend for us, and having been the only player to score at Wembley, my brain for that goal kind of said that Ronnie was sort of on his own, leaping, you know, to head the ball gloriously into the net. And when I watched the goal back, it was much harder than that. It was a much more crowded penalty area than I remembered, which is weird how your brain plays tricks with you. I mean, obviously that was a huge day out, and I was, you know, fairly young, and I'd been working at Plymouth Sound, and I never interviewed Ronnie, but I, you know, got to go sort of a little bit behind the scenes at the club and interview Neil Warnock and Mick Jones, and quite an incredible time.
Yeah, I mean, it must be nice just to even see us win at Wembley, to be honest. Like, that alone is a feat that
well, I've been twice since, and it's not been such a great day.
Bring back the old Wembley is what I say.
Yes,
obviously your first job came in radio in Plymouth, right? And you know, what was it like covering Argyle during Dan McCauley and Neil Warnock's reign?
Well, interesting, because I was very lucky to work with Gordon Sparks. He was doing the Plymouth Sound breakfast show and we got on really well. He was brilliant. And I was, you know, early 20s and it was my first proper job. So I was very green, but in more ways than one. Yeah. And but we chatted about Argyle and he was obviously very, very passionate. And but there was also a lot going on at the club that was a bit tricky. Mm. And so I did get to, you know, interview Neil Warnock when he was a bit sort of sharp after a game, because there was obviously some real tension between him and Dan McCauley. So it was an interesting time, and quite tense at times.
Yeah, I can imagine, as we know that both of those characters are very strong-willed, shall we say. So yeah,
obviously... Yeah, but there was also some like amazing news at the time, you know, when we signed Bruce Grobbelaar. And he was a huge star and also had this court case hanging over his head.
That's the match fixing one, right?
Yeah. I don't know if people like remember Bruce Grobbelaar, the Liverpool goalie who, you know, he was accused of some sort of betting match fixing scandal, and with that cloud over his head, we signed him. And I remember interviewing him on the day he turned up at Home Park, and you know, I literally had to hold out the microphone at full stretch because he was so tall. And he was very nice, but I asked him, you know, how are you going to deal with, you know, this court case hanging over your head? And he just sort of looked down at me very sternly and said, I'm going to do a terrible South African accent there. When we get to court, we'll find out who the guilty parties are. And I just sort of looked at him and, all right, Bruce, going to play on Saturday. It was, but it was great that it was brilliant that we were bringing characters like that to Argyle. Yeah, it was fun.
Who was your favorite person to interview, or is that the list? Is there
at Argyle, that you didn't really get access to the players to interview, and I wasn't doing the sports coverage, I was doing the news coverage. Right. So I would interview Dan McCauley quite a lot, and sometimes the chief exec, I can't remember his name now at the time, and rarely Neil Warnock, occasionally Mick Jones, and but yeah, we didn't really get access to the players, sadly.
Yeah, obviously we'll just cover it now actually whilst we're on it. Like, how did the club then compare to the club now? Because obviously I know that you have a very good relationship with them now, right?
It's totally different. I mean, it was I'm sure there were all sorts of things going on behind the scenes at the time. And I sort of got on all right with Dan McCauley, but he was, obviously quite a tricksy character. And it clearly wasn't as well run, let's put it that way. It was, I remember getting my one Argyle scoop, which must have been 97, I think. I found out that this doesn't sound very big, but the tannoy was broken. But what that meant was they had to close either, I can't remember, it was a whole stand or half a stand. It was just, the capacity was, I mean, the crowds weren't that big then, but the it was quite a big story. The club were very unhappy with me, but it was, you know, it was something that affected the fans. So you needed to report it. So it clearly, the club was not being, looked after in the same way as it is now. And obviously the facilities are totally different.
Yeah, you know, obviously under the current stewardship, it's going quite well. Obviously you've seen recent promotions that you were there for Argyle during that FA Cup run that you've already said that you weren't allowed to go to. Did we cover that, or was that before we started recording? I feel like that was before we started.
It might have been. But I was getting into Argyle during the cup run, and obviously that was huge in the city, and it feels sort of a different kind of feeling because cup runs in the, I mean, even if we went on a big cup run now, and even when we played Chelsea the other season, it was a big deal, but it wasn't the same as in 1984. It was such a big national story, and the FA Cup was such a big thing. You know, quarterfinals and semifinals were massive, and it's just not the same now.
No, well, I mean, it would have been very nice to actually beat Chelsea, but yeah, I'm sure it still wouldn't have compared to, you know, back then. Obviously, from that, you know, we had, you know, Sturrock's first reign, and then the pits of administration. Yes. It's been a bit of a roller coaster over the years, but any key memories that stick out in your mind?
Well, over that period, I left Plymouth itself for work in about 2000, but I was, so I've been in London and Manchester for a while, so it was mostly going to away games. I'd say most of those are sort of comical lowlights, like going to see us get absolutely battered at West Ham 5-0, or going up to Burnley and which is generally never a good thing to be doing, you know, seeing some pretty turgid 0-0 draws at York City, things like that. So and I think even in the sort of promotion season where we were, you know, top of the league having a laugh, I think I saw us lose 3-0 away to QPR because I was in London at the time. So it's been a mixed bag, let's put it that way. But that's part of the journey, isn't it? And I do remember it was a big fan favourite back in the I think it was late 90s, Alan Nichols in goal. He was a great character, and he tragically died too young, but he was a brilliant keeper, but he was a bit nuts, as keepers often are. And it was Barnet away, and one of their players was down in our half. He'd gone down, and for some reason, like, the other players were nowhere near him, but Alan Nichols was there, and he looked over at the away support and pretended to sort of did a sort of fake punch to pretended to, like, it was just sort of taking the piss, and the Argyle fans loved it. Went, gave him a big cheer. I mean, these days you'd get sent off. You wouldn't do that, but it was very funny.
It's like you said, it's those low moments and those nil nils and those, you know, those days where you genuinely consider why you're there that make it all worth it, you know.
It does, and also there was, what, having known Sparksy, and in that time when I was further away, being able to listen to him, I when you listen to other local commentators, you know, that I'm sure there are lots of good ones, but generally it's not that great. But whereas you had someone in Sparksy who was so good, was such a quality broadcaster, that it was a joy. You know, I'd often be away working in different places, but it was an absolute joy to be able to listen to him covering games that are, you know, there's no way I could get to.
As you say, I don't think there'll ever be a commentator as good as the current ones are on Argyle TV that will ever, you know, reach that sort of level. You know, like, there's certain goals and memories that you think of, and you purely think of, you know, Sparksy's commentary, mainly the, you know, Frio goal against QPR and those sorts of things. Whereas,
yeah, and there's a little, if people get the book, there's a little nod to that, which I'm sure Argyle fans will spot. But as soon as I saw the scoreline on a particular event, I thought, that's fitting.
You've mentioned the book, so let's jump on to the campaign then. Obviously, how did you first hear about Jack Lesley, and why did you feel a desire to kickstart this campaign?
It happened at a party. I was in London. My wife had a colleague, and it was his birthday. He went, "Oh, my dad's an Argyle fan. You've got to meet him." So this Argyle fan's Tony Fitzgerald, he's a great guy, and, you know, I'd seen like lists on Argyle and Jack Lesley and Sammy Black, but not really, I didn't really know much. I didn't know much about Argyle's history. He started telling me the story. I could not believe it. I thought, this must be, you know, a tale that has been blown up out of all proportion. And as soon as I, you know, got home, well, the next day with a bit of a hangover, I started looking into it and finding articles and information. And clearly there was still, you know, any Argyle fan who knows a bit, you know, knew more about Argyle's history did, were aware of it, and certainly older fans. So I started just telling all my Argyle friends, and none of them had ever heard the story. And I was surprised, because there's, you know, there's more, say, someone like Greg, who's chair of the London supporters. He is, I don't want to say, you know, more committed a fan than me, but he's probably, you know, he's been to more games. He's, you know, and he has that position. And so we were both pretty shocked that the story hadn't been told. And he's a bit of a sort of campaigning lawyer. And immediately, over, you know, a few more pints, we decided we got to do something. So it just felt like the right thing to do. And it's also kindled an interest in Argyle's history, because when you find out about what was going on and what the Argyle team were, it blows me away.
Obviously, in case any Argyle fan has been living under a rock, there might be a few of them, I'm not sure. Can you just remind us of Jack's story and about the rescinded call-up?
Yeah. So Jack was an East London lad. He played just after the First World War as a teenager, played for Barking Town, who were a big amateur club at the time. And, you know, getting 5,000, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 fans, 15,000 in cup finals. And it was at one of those that Bob Jack, the Argyle manager, spotted Jack Leslie and decided he was going to sign him. He signed three players from Barking. So in 1921, he came down, signed professionally for Plymouth, although other clubs like West Ham, Spurs, Chelsea wanted to sign him. And Argyle offered more money. Can you imagine that happening now? And and also showed him postcards of a sunny home. So, of course, if you've grown up in Plymouth, you know that that's, you know, I mean, it does happen and it's great, it's beautiful, but it's a rare occurrence. Yeah. And so he came down and he took a while to get into the team, but he then established himself and was clearly a massive talent. And in 1925, Argyle were on fire. I think they scored about something like 31 goals in 8 games. Don't quote me, but it's something like that. And Jack had scored 6. He was pictured on the front of the Daily Mirror scoring in a 6-2 win against Southend. And the FA were looking for players for the England team. And in October, 5th of October, he got chosen as one of 13 players. It was 11 and 2 reserves to travel to go with the team. So the England squad. And it was printed in all the papers. Jack had been called in to his manager's office. I mean, that's when I sort of, I've known this story for years, but when I started doing more research and thinking about it in the book, it made me think, you know, here's a young player walking from Peveril through Central Park to Home Park just for training and then getting called into his manager's office and out of the blue being told you've been picked for England. I mean, as a young player, that must have been immense. And apparently,
it's like everyone's dream, isn't it? Like, just to, just to get that, even that talk where you're like, you're going to go play for England. Like,
it would have been huge. And also, you know, the Argyle team at the time had several former England internationals. You know, in that team, Jack Cock had scored the fastest goal for England at the time. So you've got, and he'd seen other players who had, while at Argyle, being named as a reserve and then being called up for the full England team. There's one player that happened to while at Argyle, and he didn't play because of injury and then went on to win several caps while he was at another club. So there's, you know, he would have known how immense this was. And then within 2 weeks, it all kind of went quiet and people couldn't look him in the face. They couldn't look him in the eye. And he said he heard roundabout that the FA had come to have another look at him, and his name was removed from the team sheet before the game was played. And he wasn't injured. He wasn't suspended. He, on the day that England limped to a 0-0 draw in Ireland, well, in Belfast playing the Ireland team, Jack scored twice in a 7-2 win at Home Park. And yeah, he'd heard that they'd changed their mind because of the colour of his skin. And there's a reporter, a Plymouth reporter, who who was obviously a big fan of Jack, who said, reported the news, said, my pen is under a ban in the matter. And I looked at that paper from the 20s and I saw on the same page, they had this little snippets gossip column. And it says, this is the only reference to like Jack's colour in the last 4 years while he's been at Argyle. It says, interesting readers to note that the Jack Leslie, Argyle's brilliant inside left, is the only gentleman of colour in the Football League. I just thought that's that writer doing a bit of a sort of pop bitch, private eye. Yeah, you know, yeah. I'm not allowed to tell you, but here's, we all know the reason. We're all talking about it in the pubs, but I can't tell you. And I think that sort of feeling of being let down stayed with Argyle fans who love Jack Leslie.
There was an Argyle fan that brought it up when there was an article about Viv Anderson, right?
Apparently it was a woman who wrote to the Daily Mail who said, no, Viv Anderson wasn't the first to be picked. It was Jack Leslie. And then they interviewed him. And I'm really glad they did, because obviously I never got a chance to speak to Jack himself. But in that article in the Daily Mail in 1978, he tells the story, and he just tells it like it is. He wasn't someone that went out around shouting about it, but when he was asked, he just said, well, that's what happened. And also, you know, I'm not a boasting man, but I was good enough. And yeah, if you read all the reports, he absolutely was.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's painful to hear that. Like, well, it sounds as almost like he'd like come to terms with it, right? Like
it's all, 'cause I think, at the time, I mean, I don't know how he felt. You can try and imagine, but he was able to probably use football as an outlet and just sort of get on with that.
Mm.
I actually think it might have hurt more later, looking back and thinking about it and having it brought up again.
What could have been?
I certainly think it would have made such a big difference to him, maybe to other players that then emerged, and I think it would have made a big difference to his family, who his daughter was really angry throughout, you know, about what happened, and his wife, who was white, had a really tough time in Plymouth because people really disapproved of mixed marriages. I mean, they continued to, you know, I can remember some people's attitudes in the sort of even in the 80s, but back then she was apparently spat at in the street and called names. And I think had Jack been in the England team, there would have been just that acceptance.
Mm. A level of respect as well that he should have had anyway.
Yeah. 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 I mean, that's the thing. He was respected in Plymouth. He was part of, you know, Plymouth society, and was clearly well respected enough to be appointed captain, which would have been quite a step, because it's almost like you're breaking through sort of barriers that you had to be even better than anyone else. You had to be such a higher level to get that position of authority as a player of color.
Yeah, and like you say, already made reference to the fact he was the only player of color in the league, you know, so like that's, to become captain is huge in itself. But yeah, it's a shame to hear that he didn't, you know, quite make it. You obviously mentioned the family there. They're quite receptive of the campaign, right?
Yeah, they've been great. And I think it's made a big difference to them, because a lot of them talk about how they would tell other people, they would talk to friends and tell the story of their granddad, and people would just kind of go, oh, no, that never happened. Mm. But now, because it's got the attention that it deserves, and it has been talked about and reported, it was, you know, reported at the time, you know, a paper asked the FA and they just said, no, we didn't pick him. And they checked with the Press Association, who said, no, he was picked. So the FA just sort of denied it for 98 years. But they've sort of carried that with them, but by being able to tell the story, it's and for the recognition that he's had, I think it's had quite an impact. It can't change you know, that terrible injustice that happened. But I think it has really helped them.
Yeah. It, sorry if this is a stupid question, but how come Jack never played for those big clubs? Obviously, initially, we had more money.
Yeah.
But...
No, it's not a stupid question because I wondered the same thing. Yeah, you'd get people on. I wish I'd known back then what I knew now, but when I was starting the campaign, I knew the England story was true. But you get people on Twitter going, "Oh, he's not good enough. If he was good enough, he would have played for a first division club." Well, he would have played for a first division club if it were not for the fact that back then, because of the retain and transfer system, managers and club directors had all the power. Players had zero power.
Right.
So when other clubs, it was Jack's choice to join Plymouth in the first place, but there's a maximum wage. So certainly we know that by 1927, but I'm sure before he was earning the maximum wage. So he wouldn't have got paid anymore elsewhere. And we know there were several reports of first division clubs offering substantial fees to sign him. A lot of clubs came in and offered, I think as Everton basically said, name your price for Jack and Sammy Black, because they had this partnership that was so incredible. And Plymouth just said no. And the only way a player could kind of leave was by being a massive pain in the ass. Mm. And Jack wasn't that sort of character. You know, it talked about a player who got picked for England while at Argyle. It was a guy called Jack Hill, and he wanted to leave Plymouth. He was from the north. He wanted to go back to Burnley, of all places. And
that's not where anybody wants to go, is it?
No, it's not what you want to hear. Maybe we were good. Well short of him, he was a great player. I mean, he captained England after leaving Argyle. But he kicked up such a stink because he clearly didn't want to stay anymore. And apparently the FA supported him in his move, and it just became untenable. Whereas for Jack, he wasn't that sort of character anyway, and neither was Sammy Black. But also, it would have been much harder, I think, for Jack as a man of colour to stand up to the manager. In fact, the granddaughters told me that at one point where he really did want to move back to London and would have been signed by a West Ham, a Spurs, an Arsenal, Bob Jack said, "No, if you don't play, you don't get paid. End of." And Jack just had to go back to work. I think he wanted to go back. He really loved Plymouth, but he wanted to go back for personal reasons. But it might have been really great for his career as well. But he wasn't allowed to go.
Yeah, you mentioned it slightly there about the Twitter, you know, comments. Did you encounter any like real opposition to the campaign, and like how did you respond to that?
Well, we had to be really careful not to get sucked down a rabbit hole, because generally the great thing was it was almost 100% positive, because I think that even if people were you know, not you know, massively political, I think they could still see that this was someone that should be recognised and supported it, whether they were an Argyle fan or, you know, football fan of another club. So it really had an incredibly broad appeal, but you will always get the odd person. And it was basically on social media. You get the odd email. I had things on Twitter where people said stuff like, "Oh, he wasn't good enough. He just wasn't good enough." Or, you know, and then, when I've read enough now to know that he was one of the best, if not the best, for much of his career in his position at inside left, without a doubt. Well, he was named in national newspapers as such. But I would occasionally reply to comments just factually correcting people, because a lot of people would write things that just weren't correct. And that is always frustrating. You kind of go, "I know that what you're saying is bullshit, so I'm going to correct you." But you don't want to waste too much time on people that are probably never going to read the stuff anyway. But generally, I mean, it's, you know, stuff that we've just had this weekend, despite the result on the pitch, was just great. The fans were incredible at Home Park. The reception they gave the granddaughters was just great.
Yeah, yeah. I think we'll get on to the events of Saturday. Maybe there's something else that happens at Wembley. I'm sure we'll get onto that in a minute. But obviously, you know, before that, and do correct me if I'm getting my timelines muddled, I'm just living through Greg's social media. You know,
aren't we all?
Yeah, he's very active.
That's good.
Yeah, obviously, the campaign led to Argyle's only statue, which obviously portrays Jack and sits outside the ground on the corner of the Denport and the Lyndhurst stand. How does the statue campaign come around? That's the first real.
Yeah, Greg and I just felt, well, that's what we should do. And when you sort of look into it, and there's not many, for a start, we obviously knew there was no statue at Home Park, and we thought that would be a really great thing to do. And when you know Jack's story, particularly when you discover that he was a bona fide Argyle legend, then there's lots of other players that could have statues, and that would be great. But it just felt the right thing to do. I mean, what else are you going to put there to celebrate him and tell his story? Lots of other clubs have statues. Let's do one. And we were surprised. I suppose it was timing when it all kind of got picked up. But Greg and I remember Greg and I having that conversation. It's like, we've just got to go for it. It was 2020. We'll just do it. And luckily it worked out. And, you know, I hope that almost all Argyle fans, I'm sure there is a small minority who are not, but almost all have been brilliant and I think appreciate it.
Just quickly, in terms of going back and clipping stuff around, we never officially had a break, did we? Even so, you might need to say we're having a break, and now we're back from our break.
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly teaming up with Three for Mental Health Awareness Week this year. We understand that the journey as a supporter isn't always smooth sailing, but rest assured you're not alone. There's a vast network of fellow fans who share your passion and may be experiencing similar challenges. Honesty is key in any relationship. If your friend asks you how you are feeling, tell them, honestly. If you're going through a difficult time, let them know. Opening up about how you are feeling can really make a difference. After all, they are your mates for a reason. Let's all take a moment to talk more than football.
But how do you even begin to build a statue? Obviously, I can imagine it's an incredibly long, drawn-out process, right? What are the steps?
Yeah, we went into the campaign because we had to launch. It was really about raising the money. We didn't honestly know that much, but we knew how much money we'd need. We did a bit of research. So we spoke to other statue campaigns. And of course there was not long before the Nancy Astor statue, and we knew what they needed to raise. And I spoke to a guy at Peterborough who they'd recently done a statue. So I got a sense of, and Greg spoke to sort of sculptors. So we had a sense of what we'd need to build it. And then it was a case of taking time and putting the message out there and getting, we got a load of pitches. So we set a process and we had the family and a committee of people who were all there to kind of bounce the ideas off, and we got down to a short list of four, interviewed them on Zoom, and did a bit more diligence. We visited artist studios and foundries, and then chose Andy Edwards because he just He just got it, and his work was good. All four who sort of, you know, made the final shortlist had done good work, but it just felt that he got the story and was going to put everything into it. And that proved to be a good decision, because when we were able to meet the family at last, it was an event in Canning Town. There was an exhibition, and we were able to meet up in person, and Andy was there and got to chat to them. And we finally got to see, you know, some photos we'd never seen before, from that we've now, you know, some of them in the book and some of them were shared online. And it was amazing to see some of this stuff. And suddenly we had a bigger picture of what Jack was like. And yeah, we went on from there. He took some time and decided what the pose might be in conjunction with us and the family. And then, yeah, started work on the clay. It was an interesting process that was, yeah, it was eye-opening, because it's not totally outside of my comfort zone.
How did it work with the club then? Obviously, because I know Greg was talking previously, there was a big like conversation about where it was going and where it could go. And, you know, obviously it's ended up in the right place, but.
They were really good, actually. We met up with a facilities guy, and he did a little wander around. He said, oh, we've been thinking about a few different places. And when he started, like, behind the gate inside by the Mayflower stand, both Greg and I were thinking, oh, God, we don't want to put it here, because we want it to be as accessible as possible.
Yeah.
And I think in the olden days, the obvious place would have been by the old entrance, you know, where the Superstore, the Argyle store is now. And but because the Life Centre's there, it's a totally different situation. So we wandered around, and they actually suggested a few different places. And, you know, that corner where it is, the popular court, you know, Lyndhurst, Devonport, it just made sense, because you can see it walking down the hill, you can see it from the road, you can see away fans will see it going down to the Barn Park. And yeah, that was immediately, this is where it should be.
6 weeks is all it took to hit the fundraising target, if I'm remembering that rightly. You know, with people still able to donate, what is the long-term ambition for the campaign, and what sort of legacy do you aim to leave behind?
Well, it's really interesting, because we unveiled the statue a year ago, and both Greg and I, we both felt the same, in that we felt our job was done in part, but we always wanted to carry on telling the story. So, you know, we always loved, you know, we get requests to go and talk to schools or an organization, someone would say, oh, can you come, and we love doing that. And then everything happened with the cap, which then had its own momentum, which we'd asked that question at the start of the campaign and got pushback from the FA, but then not long before the unveiling, and we got to meet the new chair of the FA, Debbie Hewitt, and she just engaged with it and read the stuff on the website, and suddenly it was happening. From a no, it became a yes, and then she pushed it through in time for the unveiling ceremony, and it was just incredible. And so it's carried on. It's sort of got a life of its own. It's almost like we've got all sorts of ambitions, but they seem to be then sort of thrust upon us. But people will like ask us to do stuff, and we love doing it, because we can't say no, because it's too. I was in a school today in East Ham, where Jack's old stomping ground, you know, that's where he lived after coming back from the West Country for many, many years. And it was great talking to like primary school kids about this story that was so far away in time. They were just blown away. They were, what? He was the only black player. What?
Yeah, yeah.
He played for Plymouth Argyle. What?
Yeah.
It was great. So yeah, we loved carrying on doing stuff like that. And there's definitely going to be some interesting stuff going on. I think particularly around the anniversary of the selection, I think will be, because it was October of 1925.
Not long to prepare for that. I think
no.
A lot of your timeline and events feel like they've been not rushed through, but you've had these momentum occasions where you've had to like hurry up.
Yeah.
It was the campaign started because of the BBC, right? You did. Greg was saying something about you had to like kickstart it because the BBC wanted to write a story on it, right?
basically we'd started talking about it in 2019, talked to Simon Hallett, and we weren't ready to go anyway. And he said, look, don't be great if you didn't do anything till after the boardroom's renamed. And we were like totally fine with that, because it was clear that he wanted to do something to recognize Jack. And, you know, we didn't want to kind of suddenly go with the Jack Leslie campaign and make it look like it was responding to pressure, because it wasn't. He was doing it off his own bat. And then, you know, we got to 2020 and we thought, well, we'll set up a website, we'll start to get, you know, things going. And then everything went a bit weird. And it was, we were going to launch a game, I think it was April, it was Forest Green. And that was the first game that was cancelled due to COVID. And we'd not even met the family. They were going to be at that game. So we were totally not ready to launch. And so it would have been a shambles. But we got to meet the family, you know, talk to them on the phone and stuff, and they were on board. And then we just thought, oh, we'll put it on ice because there's no football. It's going to be really hard to raise this money. And then suddenly, I think because of the Colston statue, people saw the campaign and people started to, there was the odd article about Jack, and thought, and then the BBC, after the BBC National News, wanted to do the story. So we're like, we're never going to get this chance again, right, to have the story on the Today programme and the BBC National News at breakfast. And so we were just kind of suddenly trying to get everything in place, talking to lots of people, trying to get people prepared to give us money. And it was crazy, but it was brilliant. And it was the right thing to do, because, you know, it took off, everyone was talking about it. And one of the great things about that is, obviously, telling Jack's story is really important, but as an Argyle fan, to see that attention on the club, that positive attention, and also at a time when there is more positivity around, after so many years in the doldrums, that was a really great thing. And I'm really proud to, I don't know if I'm allowed to call myself a Janner, because I moved there when I was four, but I, you know, I grew up in Plymouth. It's my hometown. I love it. And I was really proud that positive attention was shining on the city. As much as anything else, that was really, really a great thing, I think.
Yeah, there was a period in which yourself and Greg were barely off the telly and off different events and programs.
Yeah, sorry about that.
You know, but obviously of all those appearances, that the biggest one, the one you're probably most proud of, is obviously pitch side at England versus Ukraine, when obviously Jack's family are, you know, finally awarded that England cap. That's obviously a huge honour, right? And, you know, to finally have that recognition.
Yeah, I mean, the unveiling day was massive in terms of just the sort of the pressure of delivering it and hoping that the fans were going to be...
And the equipment going wrong, right?
Yeah. Well, that was sort of... It's funny because when there was such a windy day with the sun shone, the sun sort of broke through the clouds in time for the unveiling, which was great, but it was so windy. And it was, remember I was talking about the guy that told me the story, and his son, he works in like props on TV shows, and so does my wife.
Right.
And when that happened with the drape and it was flying off, the pair of them, everyone else, like Greg and I, was still on stage going, oh, what's going on? And the pair of them ran to sort it out, because they're used to dealing with that sort of stuff in an emergency. It was great. So I saw my he was still only two. My son, I think my wife handed off my son and then ran around, and then Tony's son Joe were pulling on the drape. But it was kind of, everyone embraced it, and it was because everyone was so positive. So it was good. But yeah, there was that pressure. But the when the cap was presented, it was very emotional, because it was, you know, it was at Wembley, and you got Viv Anderson handing it over, who had supported the campaign, the first, you know, England's first black full international. Yeah, it was, I couldn't believe it was happening. And the reception, just as when we, the family brought the cap to Argyle, it was so brilliant. So yeah, just to be a part of that was, yeah, wonderful.
Me and my other half were at that game. I remember it, obviously, because, you know, talking to Greg, obviously. Mm. I think he's had more name drops in this pod than Jack himself. But and I just remember, I just finished work and met up and went to Wembley. And I just remember my other half being like, that guy looks like Greg. Like, as you came across the big screen. Oh, that is Greg. So, yeah, we're there. Right? So it must have been just a huge... Obviously, you know, Viv supported the campaign. Carlton Cole, right? Ronnie Moshe, like...
Yeah, yeah.
Big names there.
Yeah. Names. Yeah, it was great that they came on board, because it's really hard to get hold of both, you know, big-name footballers and ex-footballers. As even, you know, when we got Ronnie on board, that was immense for us because, you know, he's our hero.
Mm.
So it was just, it was great when we got hold of him, and he was, yeah, he's been brilliant throughout, actually.
Yeah, did that coincide with him becoming club ambassador as well? Because it was around the same sort of time, wasn't it? As the campaign kicking off and him becoming.
I think he got appointed to that role later, but he's always obviously been a legend for the club. And when we were able to get hold of him and he expressed his support, and you know, he joined us for a sort of Zoom, and it's also been really you know, because one of the things about the campaign, we Plymouth is more diverse than it was, but it's not, you know, the world's most diverse city, and we're Plymouth Argyle fans, that's why we're doing it, but we're two white blokes. We have done our best to engage people across the board, and Ronnie in particular has been really helpful in just pointing things out that we might not be so aware of. The lack of diverse, I mean, obviously I'm aware of the lack of diversity in boardrooms and management, but when someone like Ronnie, a black player from the East End who came down to Plymouth, tells it like it is, it hits home. And you need that. You need that presence. You need that presence in a campaign like this. You need that presence in football. And I can't praise him enough for being honest about his feelings about how football is. If there's been things that messaging around the campaign, you need someone to tell you. Yeah, you need someone to tell you who has that lived experience.
Mm. Obviously, that you alluded to it already, but obviously that the same day as our recent, should we say the word defeat? Defeat. Yeah, let's say it as it is, to Swansea City. The club were obviously awarded Jack's cap, which now proudly sits in the boardroom that bears his name. And obviously his statue sits on the road that bears his name as well. He's got quite a legacy there now. Talk us through the events that led up to the day and the day itself. And
yeah, it was when the cap was awarded at Wembley, it was brilliant, but it was really sad that Leslie, who's the eldest of the three granddaughters, the others, Lynn and Jill, she got COVID and couldn't come to Wembley, and that must have been heartbreaking for her.
Mm.
So it was really fortunate that we were at Wembley a week later. And look, let's not talk about the game, but she recovered, and Debbie Hewitt from the FA said, "I'm going to make sure that she can come." Well, she was able to show off the cap at Wembley and walk around all those, you know, nearly 40,000 Argyle fans, and with Ronnie and Greg and I, and it was, until kickoff, it was just great. And she was able to announce that they'd already decided that they wanted to bring the cap to Home Park, because there's three of them. They wanted to keep it for a little while, for a few months, just so they could, you know, share it with the family and see it. And yeah, so we were then planning for when we would bring it to Argyle. And it made sense. There was, you look, when the fixture list comes out, you're suddenly like, what's the best day for this? And there weren't many home fixtures on a Saturday in October. In fact, I think Swansea, the only, we've got Wednesday on Wednesday at the 25th, but so it was basically the only game that we could do. And it was the anniversary of the unveiling, and then we were away, and the club, as they have been, very supportive. Obviously, they're delighted that the caps come to Argyle. They gifted maquettes of the statue, which are not cheap, to the granddaughters in return. So that was a lovely gesture.
Lovely.
And yeah, it was great. And Leslie and Lynn, Jill couldn't make it this time. She's looking after her partner who's not well. But the two of them got such a great reception on the pitch. It was really, really lovely.
Yeah, it's also brilliant just to see the club just such a classy outfit now. Like, we've had issues in the past, right? But like, now it just feels like everything on and off the pitch is just clicking in the right direction. It's just absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, that there's always going to be, you know, when you're running an operation like that, and when it's football, there's always going to be ups and downs, and there's always going to be stuff that, you know, fans aren't happy about on a particular day or about a particular sort of thing. But I think in general, the club is just trying to do positive stuff, and also they're trying to make it a football club and a business that supports the community and enhances the community, and they can see when there's a positive message that it should be embraced. Mm-hmm. And it was great, you know, with you know, fans wanting pictures with the cap, you know, fans giving the granddaughters an ovation, you know, it was brilliant. And long may it continue, because that's what you need from a football club, isn't it? You need, you know, support the community and vice versa.
Yeah, so it's nothing without community, right? Like,
yeah,
it just isn't. So, and the cap's going to be on display for people that do tours and whatnot around the club, right?
Yes, yeah. I mean, deals, it was important for us that the cap would be available to show more widely, so it's not going to be locked up in the boardroom. Obviously, people who go on tours will see it, but I want it to be available as much as possible. So we'd love to see exhibitions. Nice. But now we've got more material about Jack, and wouldn't that be a lovely part of it? And I think there will be stuff like that going on. I would like it to be more accessible to the fans, if I'm honest. But if it can't be on display elsewhere, then I will do my utmost to find ways to for it to be seen outside on particular days, you know, like what we did. It obviously won't be as big as the other at Swansea, but we'll take it out of its case and take it to round the stands. We'll take it to the taverners, which we did on, Greg did on Saturday. You know, it's really important that we do that.
And Greg making a trip to the pub doesn't sound like Greg.
Imagine Greg in hospitality. Well, both of us, yeah. To be fair.
You've been busy writing a book. I can imagine a lot of what we spoke about is encompassed and a lot more, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it is been a great privilege because I always wanted, when I was little, I wanted to be a history professor. I gave that up when I decided that they were all mad. I mean, that's probably not entirely fair if there are any history professors listening, but I've always had a passion for it. And so one of the great things about doing the campaign was learning about Jack's story and learning about the Argyle team. There's obviously great stuff out there already with things like Greens on Screen, which was invaluable to me. And the Plymouth Argyle Heritage Archive. There's lots of stuff that I looked at from both those resources. But it's just been great delving into like more and more. There's stuff in there in the book that I don't think is available elsewhere. Some incredible Argyle stories. And you know, Jack wasn't he was brilliant. He was immense. He was well liked in the dressing room. He was a very charismatic man, an incredibly talented player, but he wasn't perfect. He was a human being. And the granddaughters told me all their stories. And obviously a lot of those have passed through their mum and therefore through their grandmother, Jack's wife, Wyn. And, you know, they told me about the ups and downs. You know, he was a young player. He was, you know, and then maybe it went to his head a little bit. The players were out having a laugh. All that's in there. It's been a real privilege to research it and to write it. Yeah, I loved it.
The forewords by Viv Anderson as well, right? So it's another huge...
Yeah, no, it was really, really nice that people have supported it because I did an interview the other day and they said, oh, the acknowledgements are like an entire chapter. It's like, well, yeah, because so many people have helped, but I think because they have been engaged with the story and care about it. And I've wanted to have those people help me to make it as hopefully as good as it can be. So it tells his story from childhood, from his dad sort of coming over from Jamaica and ending up in London, to Jack coming down to Plymouth, and after his career, which was ended prematurely by a terrible eye injury, which is really, he would have played many more games and scored many more goals for Argyle, but he went to run a pub in Truro, and that didn't necessarily go entirely well, but it was funny what happened there. And then back to the East End, and then to West Ham in the boot room, of course, which is sort of a bittersweet ending. But he loved that job and got to, some of the memories of some of the players that he met there are great, and show what kind of a really well liked, charismatic man he was, who should have got the chance to play for the country that he loved. He was a patriot.
Yeah, not to reveal everything in the book, but there's a story about the players at West Ham not knowing who he was, right?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. What I found it was when he went to West Ham, there would have been some people who knew, because there was an old guy who he played against while at Argyle. So there's Albert Walker, who played for West Ham, and so they were on opposite sides. But the bigger names, like, you know, Bobby Moore and Jeff Hurst and Martin Peters, but then the ones that we've been able to talk to, Trevor Brooking and Clive Best, they never knew that he was even a professional player, because he didn't talk about it. They were obviously busy just going in and out of the boot room. They would sort of pass the time of day and say hello, and said, you know, he was a brilliant, lovely man. But they were staggered to find out that he was, you know, such a talented player with such a great record, but also that he'd been picked for England. You know, Jack had never gone, oh, yeah, well, he'd never boasted about any of his achievements, which I think is a testament to his character.
What's the rest of this year got left in store for yourself and the campaign? Is there any future aims to adapt this to TV or film?
Well, I've worked in, after my stint at Plymouth Sound, I've had a TV and film, well, not really film, not for the want of trying, a TV career. I'd love it to, it's doing stuff like that is slightly in the lap of the gods. But it would be great. But really, it's right now, I'm obviously promoting the book as much as I can, because, look, you know, I think it's a story that deserves to be told. And, writing a book is not, I can assure you, something that's going to make you rich. But I, you know, my wife's been very, very supportive over the last year of me doing this. It's been quite a thing. But what a privilege. And I would love as many people to read it as possible, because I think it's a story worth knowing about. And I think for Argyle fans as well, there's what I found in just writing and thinking about it, I found some incredible stories. I mean, there's things that we know, like the Argentina tour and the South America tour, and there was this great cup game against Arsenal. It's kind of tragically funny in a classic Argyle way, it was a really fun to write, but also really thought provoking. And to think of the impact that those weeks in October 1925 had on a young man really is affecting, I think.
Before you go then, remind everybody where they can get this, the book, obviously, The Lion Who Never Roared.
Yes. So it's out on the 23rd of October. It's available everywhere. You will be able to get it in the club shop. So, you know, if you're an Argyle fan, go Home Park, buy it there. But you will also be able to buy signed copies direct through the Jack Leslie campaign website. So if you go to jacklosley.co.uk and you go on the shop, you will be able to buy it from there. And if you buy it from there, it will mean some money will go to support the campaign, because it really helps. Buying it from direct means more comes our way. So that will really help. So yeah, jacklosley.co.uk, and you'll be able to get it from there if you would like a signed copy. I'm not going to say that that will increase its value, but
decrease it slightly, somewhat.
Possibly, but you know, I'll scrawl on it.
Nice. And what, you can pre-order from your website as well, or do you have to wait till the 23rd?
You will be able to, yes.
Thanks for joining us, Matt. Appreciate that. Unless you've got anything else to add at the end, but I think actually the best bet would be to read the book, right?
Yeah, I think, yes, of course. And feel free to drop Greg and I a line. We're always happy to kind of answer questions. And if people want to us to come and talk about Jack. I should also mention that I'm having a book launch at Argyle, which is already going to be very busy. But there are, if there are any left, a few tickets through the National Football Museum. But if you go on our website, there'll be details there. But if you look at the National Football Museum website, there's Football Writing Festival, and they are coming down to film it as part of their content. I'm doing a Q&A with Richard Amofa from The Athletic, who helped out, was a consultant on the book. Richard's great. So he's going to host a Q&A. And that's on the 24th of October at Home Park. So there are a few tickets for members of the public. So have a look at that, and come if you can, because it's going to be a really good night. Yeah, brilliant.
Brilliant. So obviously pre-order the book, get your ticket for the writing festival, and and follow you obviously on all socials.
Yeah. And there's a couple of London-based Argyle fans. There's a couple of London events as well. So yeah, you can find stuff about that.
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks for joining me, Matt. Appreciate that.
Nice one. Not at all. It was, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you. Cheers. That's the end of another episode of Green and White, brought to you by Argyle Life. Before you go, please make sure you drop us a review on whichever podcast platform you are using, and make sure you follow us on Twitter at Argyle Life 1886. Cheers.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly teaming up with Three for Mental Health Awareness Week this year. We understand that the journey as a supporter isn't always smooth sailing, but rest assured you're not alone. There's a vast network of fellow fans who share your passion and may be experiencing similar challenges. Honesty is key in any relationship. If your friend asks you how you are feeling, tell them honestly. If you're going through a difficult time, let them know. Opening up about how you are feeling can really make a difference. After all, they are your mates for a reason. Let's all take a moment to talk more than football.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network.
TalkSport. Powered by fans.